these stories are just so singular and so beautiful. And the boat, in some ways, I think, because it's so great, it can overshadow how good the other ones are, too. I'm returning to the boat.
This is The Lonely Voice with Peter Orner from Texas Public Radio. I'm Yvette Benavides. What do we inherit from the places we come from? A landscape, a language, a way of seeing the world, maybe even a sense of who we're meant to become. In Alistair MacLeod's short story, The Boat, a young man grows up on the rugged coast of Cape Breton Island, where his family's life is shaped by the sea. The ocean provides for them, but it also demands something in return. It becomes a symbol of the ties that hold a family together and the forces that can pull them apart. MacLeod was known for writing about communities caught between tradition and change. His stories explore the tensions between loyalty and independence, between the lives we inherit and the lives we imagine. The Boat, first published in 1968, captures a deeply human struggle, honoring where we come from while finding the courage to choose our own path. At the center of the story is a son, shaped by his family's complicated relationship with the sea. His mother loves the ocean and the life it represents, while his father is a fisherman because of tradition and expectation, even though he seems drawn to books and a different kind of life. The son grows up caught between those worlds, connected to his family and his home, but also wanting to find his own path. That conflict is familiar across generations and cultures. Many of us know what it means to feel connected to a place, a family, or a history, while wondering whether we're meant to follow a different path. Leaving can feel like a betrayal. Staying can feel like a sacrifice. MacLeod's writing is quiet and thoughtful. He brings the world of the story to life through the sound of the wind, the work of fishing, and the silence between family members. He invites us to think about the choices that shape our lives. The Boat is also a story about memory. It's told by a narrator looking back, trying to understand the people and experiences that formed him. As we know here on The Lonely Voice, sometimes the stories that stay with us are not the ones that give us answers. They are the ones that leave us with questions. On this episode of The Lonely Voice, we'll explore Alistair MacLeod's story about family, identity, ambition, and the powerful ties between a person and the place they call home. Here now, Peter Orner and I discuss The Boat by Alistair MacLeod.
We can say it's a classic story, and what does that mean? I don't know. Canadians must revere it as much as we do, but anyone, you know, who lives for stories like we do, this would be a story that would enter their consciousness and stay forever, don't you think?
Yes, anyone. And they have been translated to how many languages? And I was thinking about that, too. Like, that's why literary translation is something I will always love and champion, because, you know, of a story like this, knowing that it's out there in multiple languages and affecting people, I'm sure, deeply affecting people. But the boat, I started to count the number of times the boat is mentioned. The words the boat are in this story. They're many, especially on the very first page. But tell me why you love this story.
I love the story for reasons I can't explain, but I could say that it's the patience of it. And, you know, there are a handful of writers in my life who I feel like literally slow me down. I can look even in the very first section of the story, which is extraordinary and also completely unnecessary to the story, but also obviously intrinsic to it, that you couldn't imagine it without it. But it starts, there are times even now when I wake at 4 o'clock in the morning with the terrible fear that I have overslept, when I imagine that my father is waiting for me in the room below the darkened stairs, or that the shore-bound men are tossing pebbles against my window while blowing their hands and stomping their feet impatiently on the frozen, steadfast earth. You know, it's just a extraordinary, lengthy first sentence that literally kind of just captures you, you know, in the way that, you know, we say you're supposed to do or try and do, and so few opening lines truly do it, kind of like to play it out in that rhythmic way to pull us in is gorgeous. It's not a move that he always makes, you know. You can kind of only do something like this once in a way, I think. But it's an opening that who can't relate to, just feeling that fear that you're oversleeping because you're missing something that has long passed, you know? And I think he uses that to beautiful effect to bring us to that place. And I feel like the whole first section of this guy being far away from his home and waking up with that anxiety that he's missing his time on the boat with his father, which is long past. It's just, you know, it's universal and here extraordinarily expressed.
It is interesting that it slows you down because there's so much compression in it too. I love that about his writing too. It's also, he's waking up at 4 o'clock and with the terrible fear that he has overslept. There's muscle memory here, but I feel like there's a little bit of, I don't want to overstate it, but that's trauma. That's a little bit of that sort of complex trauma from childhood that's so ingrained, you know, that rears its head when he's an adult and has so moved on with his life and is so far away from the boat and that childhood. And there's a lot we don't know just in that first paragraph, but when I go back to reread, you know, I'm sort of struck by that idea. Then there are times when I am half out of bed and fumbling for socks and mumbling for words before I realize that I am foolishly alone, that no one waits at the base of the stairs, and no boat rides restlessly the waters of the pier. Yeah, so that's from the very beginning. I mean, it just grabs you and you just want to know more.
And it's an entire arc of a story right there, is he wakes up thinking, oh no, he's missed the time. You know, he's got to get up and get ready to go on the boat to fish with his father. And then, you know, he realizes he's half out of bed before he realizes that's not happening. It's like you get an entire, it's like McLeod gives us the whole story before he tells us it. And absolutely, I mean, trauma that emerges at the very end or towards the end with what he witnesses it becomes our trauma, you know?
Yeah.
And it's a trauma of witness.
Yeah, and you know, what's so interesting about this first part is where you have a lot of questions sort of walking into it. Things will take shape. But when he says, at such times, only the gray corpses on the overflowing ashtray beside my bed bear witness to the extinction of the latest spark and silently await the crushing out of the most recent of their fellows. I always love reading writing about cigarettes and smoking. And I feel like it's just it's such a mundane thing that you wouldn't really give it a second thought, but it's, I don't know. I love the way he does it here and later in discussing the father's cigarettes all over the place.
And yeah, there's that beautiful line where the smoke it alerts the father to kill it because it's on the floor. It's a much more elegant way to put it. Andre Debussy used to talk about, like, and I think this is maybe a term of art he picked up somewhere else, but, you know, a cigarette moment where you'd kind of pause and, you know, do that. And that would kind of give the character a chance or the writer a chance to kind of figure out what to do next, you know, kind of. So it can be done badly, you know, it can be done cheesily, but not here. God, not here.
Yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about. I had a writing instructor that would call it the bathtub moment. Sybil Baker told me it was the bathtub moment where the character's like sitting in the tub thinking, and she said, like, don't ever have any bathtub moments in your stories. Yeah.
See, I mean, I want to read those bathtub stories. That's what I like.
She was really against that.
I think I get what she's, you know, after there.
Yeah. And then because I'm afraid to be alone with death, I dress rapidly, make a great to-do about clearing my throat, turn on both faucets in the sink, and proceed to make loud splashing and effectual noises. I think that people who live alone really understand this love language that he's talking about here, that he's sharing here. And then he walks the mile to the all-night restaurant. When he says, in the winter, it is a very cold walk, and there are often tears in my eyes when I arrive. The waitress usually gives a sympathetic little shiver and says, "Boy, it must be really cold out there. You got tears in your eyes." "Yes," I say, "it sure is. It really is." That paragraph for me is so critical because for some reason it sets a tone for me of what I'm about to walk into. It's not just like, what is this guy afraid he overslept and because why and he's smoking and he's going to walk. But those tears, even though they're likely created by the cold wind outside in the walk, there's something about the idea of the tears there that I'm carrying with me through the rest of the entire story.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's why this opening is just so gorgeous. And also, you know, the rest of the story is a very specifically placed trajectory. But the opening wraps its arm around anyone who has woken up in the night to a grief-struck memory and then walked to an all-night diner and kind of for the safety of that light, think of, Nighthawks, opera painting, this is it, This is a in prose, and the story, doesn't quite really start until after this sort of overture that I really think kind of just brings anyone in. And then comes, I first became conscious of the boat in the same way and at almost the same time that I became aware of the people it supported. And there's just interesting politics and economics in this story, comments on tourism and all of these things. But of course, at the very heart, it's a fairly simple story about somebody who leaves home and his parents and his sisters, which I'm sure we're going to talk about.
Yeah, but the other thing we walk in knowing is that he teaches at a great Midwestern university.
Which is really the only thing we end up knowing about this guy.
Yeah, exactly. About what became of him. And it's so, I'm not going to say it's one-dimensional because that's wrong. You're right. It's the only thing we know. It's really the only thing we know about him.
Yeah.
And so it's a kind of a telling its slant in a way. It's really all we need to know.
Because he doesn't become a fisherman, as his mother wanted him and his father didn't want him to become. And, it's a little hard not to conflate McLeod. I have no idea if this story is true or not, and I'm sure there's stuff out there which says one way or the other. But I do know he taught at University of Windsor, across from Detroit, and that, teaching at the University of Windsor was a hell of a lot different than living in Cape Breton, and that's our guy here. I mean, arguably. And I think of that as sort of like this point of departure where he's like trudging his way to work in a large urban school. You don't think of Windsor as being the Midwest, but of course it is. In fact, as anyone Michigander will tell you, Windsor is south of Detroit. But we don't have to go into that. Because if you look on a map, that's how it is. Anyway, I'm hesitant to almost like to go into some story when I was in college and we took some bus and we went to Windsor because you could drink. You could drink in Windsor. So that's the only reason I know it's south. And I think we took a ferry or I don't know. Anyway, so that's McLeod. A little bit of what we know about him is that he grew up in Cape Breton and he ended up teaching at University of Windsor. That's what I know. But who cares?
No, that's interesting. But you're right. The very next thing is his becoming aware of the boat and the first time he went on a ride in the boat. And the things that he describes are so beautifully detailed. I mean, it is the eye of a child that's so impressed by everything. And there are very specific things that are just burned on his brain forever. I mean, and we know how this works. Like we are carrying around childhood memories that work that same way. So the sound of the rubber boots galumphing along the gravel beach, the tune of the indecent little song he used to sing, and the color of the salt. And he's on the father's shoulders. The floor of the boat permeated with the same odor and its constancy, I was not aware of change. In the harbor, we made our little circle and returned, and how the dad tied the boat. And these little tiny things, possibly memories reinforced by other times he went out there, but he remembers the first time. And then the earliest recollection of the mother. And so he gives us these sections that are about, like, I have a photocopy of the story, but I have the book next to me, but I didn't want to write in it this time. But I have section on cigarettes, section on the mother, section on the boat, mother, father's room, books, cigarettes, you know, and it's, and sisters. And you sort of come to see the idea of the house, of their house in a very particular way, of the boat in a very particular way. But we are really inside this house. Like, the boat is such a thing. It's like such an important thing for the story, obviously. But it's the house and the room, the father's room and the kitchen. It's just so interesting to me how we are in these places and then what they come to represent for the boy or and for the man in hindsight. And I don't know what I'm saying except that, you know, the house, it becomes a place of problems. And then I think, no, it's the boat that's the problem. And then I don't know if I need to decide.
Yeah, and what house isn't a place of problems, right? And there's something so memorable about the way that he constructs and puts us in this place. You know, the father has this room in the house that is exclusively his, and the rest of the house, which is a total disaster and a mess, and he's got books everywhere, and he doesn't ever sleep inside the bed. He sleeps on top of the covers, and he's got paperbacks everywhere, and he's always lying on that bed smoking. And it's a no-go zone for the mother, who's got this rest of the house is immaculate. There's a bunch of kids, we don't even know how many, you know. Mm-hmm. So you have this sort of like almost, I mean, it's almost very kind of easy. It's like a one, there's this like space that his father lives in that, you know, my father's bed was against the south wall. It always looked rumpled and unmade because he lay on top of it more than he slept within any folds it might have had. Beside it, there was a little brown table, an archaic gooseneck reading lamp, a battered table radio, a mound of wooden matches, one or two packages of tobacco, a deck of cigarette papers, and an overflowing ashtray cluttered its surface. The brown larva of tobacco shreds and the gray flecks of ash covered both the table and the floor beneath it. The once varnished surface of the table was disfigured by numerous black scars. The incredible specificity of this particular room is extraordinary. And it's like, you know, this is like one of the rooms of my life, you know, that I'll always remember. And I mean, literally just a few weeks ago, I was working on a story where I definitely had this room in mind. Hmm. You know, it's just always kind of on my mind.
His lists are perfect.
Awesome. Yeah.
And they're everywhere. I mean, right above that, there was a 5-foot board which bore a variety of clothes hooks and the burdens of each. Beneath the board, there was a jumble of odd footwear, mostly of rubber. There was also on the wall a barometer, a map of the marine area, on and on. These lists, and they're just perfect. And not everybody can do this kind of list description, but he does it so effectively and so beautifully. But do you mind if I talk a little bit about the mother? My mother ran her house as her brothers ran their boats. Everything was clean and spotless and in order. She was tall and dark and powerfully energetic. In later years, she reminded me of the women of Thomas Hardy, particularly Eustacia Vye, in a physical way. She fed and clothed a family of 7 children, making all of the meals and most of the clothes. She grew miraculous gardens and magnificent flowers and raised broods of hens and ducks. She would walk miles on berry-picking expeditions and hoist her skirts to dig for clams when the tide was low. She was 14 years younger than my father, whom she had married when she was 26 and had been a local beauty for a period of 10 years. My mother was of the sea, as were all of her people, and her horizons were the very literal ones she scanned with her dark and fearless eyes. It's a very almost romantic description of the mother, meaning a very, you know, very positive one, almost a very superficial one, but still with a little bit of, but still very profound. And then it goes to the father's bedroom right after that. So we learn all this stuff about the mom, and then we enter the father's space. And then we go to the books. Magazines and books covered the bureau and competed with the clothes for domination of the chair. They further overburdened the heroic little table and lay on top of the radio. They filled a baffling and unknowable cave beneath the bed, and in the corner by the bureau, they spilled from the walls and grew up from the floor. It's gorgeous. It's the best. And then the magazines, and then more on the books. So as you said, it's like this little inner sanctum inside this impeccably clean house that the mother has worked so hard to keep clean. And then there's this kind of man cave, you know, in the middle of the place that she cannot stand and she will not be part of anymore. So
Joyce Carol Oates, who to her great credit often spots a writer before anybody else does, and my understanding, and I might be wrong, is that the first appearance of MacLeod in the U.S. Was through Ontario Review Press, tiny press that Joyce Carol Oates ran with her husband. And so I have in front of me a copyright 1988, and yeah, first printing in the United States of America. And she has a wonderful, very concise preface at the beginning where she just kind of identifies what I just heard in that extraordinary paragraph about the mother. And she calls it incantatory prose, which I think is so accurate. And she also says this: when Alistair MacLeod published his first collection of stories, The Lost Salt Gift of Blood, in 1976, it was noted that there were 7 stories in the book and it took 7 years to write them. MacLeod's second collection, As Birds Bring Forth the Sun, which consists of 7 stories also, was published a decade later. This is to suggest that there is nothing in the volume at hand that has not been deliberated at length, nothing written in haste or for ephemeral purposes. And, you know, she goes on to sort of talk about that level of patience. I just wanted to point that out because I think that paragraph that you read about the mother is, in some ways, is one of the most beautiful. And then to me, even though the image, which we won't tell you all about because you got to read the story for yourself, where the story lands will haunt you, I think, forever if you read it. To me, one of the most devastating paragraphs is before that, and it's about the mother, but we can get into that later, but I just wanted to point that out. But this sort of slow unfolding of this life in Cape Breton, he's a fisherman, she's a fisherman's wife, but she goes, her commitment to the life they live is really through her. And that's kind of what, like, the great tension of the story is that she's trying to hold on to something that's going away, and the father, who's the one that's out there on the boat, is sort of doing it. It's hard to know. He's doing it because it's what his father did before him. It's what she wants him to do. But there's a stoniness in their relationship that is heartbreaking. He says that, you know, she never really spent any more time in his father's bedroom after he was born. So she sort of, you know, their relationship is kind of over, at least physically. And they live in these 2 separate spaces with 2 separate kind of worldviews. It has a very simple kind of aspects to it that are so, I don't want to say relatable, but I just did. Anyway, I'll shut up.
The sisters like the dad's room. They don't mind it. They like to go in there and read his stuff. And it makes the mother angry. And shortly after my sisters began to read the books, they grew restless and lost interest in darning socks and baking bread, and all of them eventually went to work as summer waitresses in the seafood restaurant. My mother despised the whole operation. She said the restaurant was not run by our people. It was an American owner. And our people did not eat there, and that it was run by outsiders for outsiders. Who are these people anyway, she would ask, tossing back her dark hair. And what do they, though they go about with their cameras for 100 years, know about the way it is here? And what do they care about me and mine, and why should I care about them? She was angry that my sisters should even conceive of working in such a place, and more angry when my father made no move to prevent it, and she was worried about herself and about her family and about her life. Sometimes she would say softly to her sisters, "I don't know what's the matter with my girls. It seems none of them are interested in any of the right things." and sometimes there would be bitter, savage arguments. One afternoon I was coming in with 3 mackerel I'd been given at the wharf when I heard her say, "Well, I hope you'll be satisfied when they come home knocked up and you'll have had your way." It was the most savage thing I'd ever heard my mother say, not just the words, but the way she said them. And I stood there in the porch, afraid to breathe for what seemed like the years from 10 to 15, feeling the damp, moist mackerel with their silver, glassy eyes growing clammy against my leg. That's one of those moments in childhood, you know, where the earth falls off its axis, you know?
Yeah.
When we see our parents say the worst things we've ever heard in our whole lives, coming from our parents, saying it to each other. It's such a moment, and of course he remembers this. And the other thing that's so interesting to me is, just to go through it here, I could spend a day on every sentence.
I have one question before you move on, and I've been wanting to ask you this question. So he's got 6 sisters, right? How do you make of the way that they are, you know, a writer who has such ability to be specific blends the sisters kind of together, and it is such an example of that kind of conflation. But these are his sisters, so how did you take that? And you know, is it a, you know, we can say that every word in this story is chosen, we can praise it to the skies, but is there a criticism to be made for the fact that the sisters are all kind of a massive crowd, and we don't even get their individual names?
I know, I have thought about that. It's like they're an amalgamation. It's always like the sisters, my sisters. On one August day, my sisters prevailed upon my father, and I'm like, which ones, right? All of them. There's so many of them, and they're all kind of doing the same thing. I'm one of 3 sisters in my family, and I can tell you this was not the case with us. So, I mean, I think a composite sister, you know, it's a sort of like this composite thing. And I don't know if it's just so that he can tell the story of the father and the mother and himself.
But, I mean, you're from a lot bigger family than mine. And it seems to me that if you do come from a bigger family, there are moments where you conflate. where the people can in your memory and mind act as one, you know. And I'm just wondering if that, you know, like, you, would you ever say something like, you know, my sisters and I, we did X, even though it may not have been all 3 of you marching in lockstep, you know what I mean? So
sure.
I don't know, I kind of felt like, I'm not trying to make excuses for it, but just to say that I can see that, especially being the one son in a family of 6 daughters, that they would, you know, and of course he knows their names, and of course he loves each one of them individually. But I felt like, he gets away with it because of it. Just, I could see that sort of cavalcade of sisters,
yeah.
You know, but as you say, the story's about the parents, you know. It's not, and he's got other stories where the sisters are sure as hell delineated, you know,
yeah.
or a sister. Yeah, there's no other, to my knowledge, a sister, a story of 6 sisters again. But I just wanted to point that out. He at one point in the story, he actually acknowledges it and says, "I say this now with a sense of, oh no, that's not where it is. Sorry." There was a moment where he sort of acknowledges it, and I'll get to that. But there's these pullbacks where he does, where he'll say, "I say this now as if I knew it all then, all at once, but the boat's dimensions and engines is a different topic." See, I'm all over the place. I'm sorry.
No, yes, I say this as if it all happened at once, and as if all my sisters were identical ages, and like so many lemmings going into another sea.
That's it. That's it.
Yeah, that's it.
So I think we need to isolate that, because that's the way there's something about when a story acknowledges not necessarily a weakness, but a kind of movies making. And he says, like, "I get it. Of course it wasn't quite like this, but in my mind, in my memory, in the way I'm having to tell you this, it has to be that." And where's that paragraph? Can you read it?
Yes. I say this again as if it all happened at once and as if all my sisters were of identical ages and like so many lemmings going into another sea, and again, it was of course not that way at all. Yet go they did, to Boston, to Montreal, to New York, with the young men they met during the summers and later married in those faraway cities. The young men were very articulate and handsome and wore fine clothes and drove expensive cars. All of them. And my sisters, as I said, were very tall and beautiful with their copper-colored hair and were tired of darning socks and baking bread. He's repeating that, darning socks and baking bread, as if that, you know, equals a life. I mean, it's a compression of a sort, but it's a synecdoche of a life. One by one they went. My mother had each of her daughters for 15 years, then lost them for two, and finally forever. None married a fisherman. My mother never accepted any of the young men, for in her eyes they seemed always a combination of the lazy, the effeminate, the dishonest, and the unknown. They never seemed to do any physical work, and she could not comprehend their luxurious vacations, and she did not know whence they came nor who they were. And in the end, she did not really care, for they were not of her people, and they were not of her sea. And, you know, the sisters before that, he says, each year, another of my sisters would read the books and work in the restaurant. So this is the other thing about the sisters. I think in this space, they don't have a lot of opportunity to sort of distinguish themselves. I don't know. I don't know how to say it, because they obviously, I mean, I don't want to say that at all. But they are all sort of doing the same thing. And it's like they are a composite. Yeah, it's like and they move through the story all kind of doing the same things year after year. And there's a lot of them. So the age range is tremendous, too.
Right.
But it kind of goes to how there isn't much opportunity for them. And they're either going to end up like their own mother.
Yeah.
Or they're going to go off and do something else. And are they getting their crazy ideas from these books? Perhaps. Perhaps.
Right. One of them gets slapped.
Oh my gosh.
You don't know which one, but one of them gets slapped for reading the book. There's a hilarious line about he gets these boxes of random books. So one of them has a Penguin Poets edition of Gerald Manley Hopkins arrived in the same box as a little book on sex technique called Getting the Most Out of Love. The former, the Manley Hopkins, had been assiduously annotated by a very fine hand using a very blue-inked fountain pen, while the latter had been studied by someone with very large thumbs, the prints of which were still visible in the margins. At the slightest provocation, it would open almost automatically to particularly graphic and well-smudged pages. Right? It's just the brilliance of this is just, but there's something about the specificity and the generalization in this story that somehow comes together to work. We get such specificity there. We get actual names of titles, and then we get these massive sisters, and we get the mother completely dismissing everything about the tourists, which makes a lot of sense. You know, they're coming to destroy their life.
Yes.
But, you know, they're being fished out. This is not going to last. This is not going to last. The father knows it, and the mother probably knows it too, but she's going to hold on as long as she can, even though the six sisters leave and the one son leaves.
Yeah.
And that's that paragraph towards the end that just always just gets me in the gut of her remaining.
The sisters make their money, and they even buy something for the mom. Many things, clothes of the type she was very fond of, the wide-brimmed hats and the brocaded dresses, but she locked them all in trunks and refused to wear any of them. And, you know, she doesn't really have a relationship with even her grandchildren later on. It's a very, the mom to me, I mean, everybody in the story, but the mother is somebody I don't want to say I understand her. I know her. I know her. I know the father. And I know the son. I mean, I think I even know the sisters. You know, I know these people. I know their quirks and their biases and their angers, their chronic kind of sorrow. I don't know. I don't know what I'm saying. But it's just, they're so familiar to me. It's like the things he remembers about childhood that are pinpoint descriptions, right? These impressions that just stayed with him forever. Like, I know those, even though I'm a bazillion miles away from this space, but I understand the attention or something. I don't know. Like this, I was just approaching the wharf to deliver my mother's summons when he began, and the familiar yet unfamiliar voice that rolled down from the cabins made me feel as I had never felt without really knowing it. And I was ashamed yet proud, young yet old, and saved yet forever lost. And there was nothing I could do to control my legs which trembled, nor my eyes which wept, for what they could not tell.
He's listening to his father sing to the tourists as a kind of, I don't know. Well, they call him our Ernest Hemingway. Like he's a tourist attraction at this point.
Yeah.
And he's getting into it. He loves it. You know, he loves the attention. And the mother's down in her house, their house, scowling and furious. And he recognizes something in that moment that is kind of, the end of everything or something. And the way that he words that paragraph that you just read, you could be doing this for, eight decades and not figure out how to, syntactically put that together as he does in that moment.
Oh, yes. And that section on Hemingway, they sent him a picture which had been taken on the day of the sinking, and it said to our Ernest Hemingway, and the hour was underlined. God, that detail.
Yeah.
There was also an accompanying letter telling him how much they had enjoyed themselves, how popular the tape was proving, and explaining who Ernest Hemingway was. In a way, it almost did look like one of those unshaven, taken in Cuba pictures of Hemingway. My father looked both massive and incongruous in the setting. His bulky fisherman's clothes were too big for the green and white lawn chair in which he sat, and his rubber boots seemed to take up all of the well-clipped grass square. The beach umbrella jarred with his sunburned face, and because he had already been singing for some time, his lips, which chapped in the winds of spring and burned in the water glare of summer, had already cracked in several places, producing tiny flecks of blood at their corners and on the whiteness of his teeth. The bracelets of brass chain which he wore to protect his wrists from chafing seemed abnormally large, and his broad leather belt had been slackened, and his heavy shirt and underwear were open at the throat, revealing an uncultivated wilderness of white chest hair bordering on the semi-controlled stubble of his neck and chin. His blue eyes had looked directly into the camera, and his hair was whiter than the two tiny clouds that hung over his left shoulder. The sea was behind him. And that's not even like, oh, what a digression. Like, what is all this? Oh, no. It's so perfect just right there.
Yeah.
It is.
And I would say that this is a person he lives with and knows well what he looks like. But there's something about receiving this photograph. First of all, they explain who Hemingway is as if these people are complete idiots and they have no idea who Hemingway is. Of course, the father knows Hemingway. The mother doesn't care because she thinks Hemingway is irrelevant. But the kid certainly knows who he is. But they're so condescending, they actually tell him who he is. But he, of course, tells us, he's like, in a way, it almost did look like one of those unshaven, taken in Cuba pictures of Hemingway. In other words, I know who Hemingway is. But the fact that he takes so much time to give us what his father looks like in this photograph, it's like it creates this kind of weird distance that is already starting to happen, even though he is still home and still going out on the boat with his dad. But he already can see into the future, like that moment that you read. I was ashamed yet proud, young yet old, and saved yet forever lost. And there was nothing I could do to control my legs, which trembled, nor my eyes.
I think when he turns, is it 15, is when there's this kind of understanding about the father that's really taking shape for him, I think.
Right.
And maybe it was there all along, but I think at around 15, here, during the winter that I was 15, he seemed to grow old and ill all at once. Most of January, he lay upon the bed smoking and reading and listening to the radio while the wind howled about the house and the needle-like snow blistered off the ice-covered harbor, and the doors flew out of people's hands as if they did not cling to them like death. Oh my God, the descriptions. But yeah, something shifts. Like the story takes a little bit of a turn here, mm-hmm. and we go into a kind of a different space with the story, and then you know the Moby Dick reference, the Tempest. I mean, you start to see these literary references. I mean, really all throughout the story, which I love. But you know, it comes back to this idea of what was missing in the life of the father,
right.
And what the son gets to live out, you know, gets to experience. Even what the daughters get to experience in a very real way as well.
Yeah, and then as you say, the turn that happens is first of all the daughters are gone, and he's left, and the mother has her hopes pinned on the son, that he's going to continue to be a fisherman. This is not an example that is at all relevant, but I remember when my dad kind of understood that I wasn't going to become a lawyer like him. You know, that I wasn't going to, my dad had a small law firm and he spent his whole life creating and building. And, you know, I just think at one point he knew, like, there was no way in hell my brother or I were going to, you know, take the train down to LaSalle Street and walk from the Chicago Northwestern Station down Randolph Street to LaSalle Street and go up to his office in the American National Bank building for 35 years. It just wasn't going to happen. And I think in a weird way, it reminded me of that. Like, it's just like, there's no way that this kid is going to take over this boat and become a fisherman. But that's the end. That is the end of the line. And there's a certain kind of almost like, again, like possibly criticizable idea in the story that, oh, he's got one choice. It's either become the man of letters or the fisherman. You know what I mean? And his dad's on one side, his mom's on the other. But you know, I buy it. You know, would Alistair MacLeod have written this story later on in his career when the stories kind of change and become, you know, maybe not such easy dichotomies? You know, probably not. But this, to start with this, damn, you know, every word, as we say, every word. But there is a kind of, you know, oh, this is the, and he makes a choice, and then he's, but then you think about the beginning of the story is, did he have a triumphal life because he left this? No, he's carrying it around with him. And so that's just, the melancholy of it is so palpable, and it has to bring you back to your own decisions and how they have come to nothing too, you know, or not nothing, but they were different. They brought you to a different place.
Yeah. I mean, it for me, it sort of starts with my father did not tan. He never tanned. Because of his reddish complexion. It's like even physically, he's not built for this life.
Yeah.
And he says, I saw then that summer many things that I had seen all my life as if for the first time. And I thought that perhaps my father had never been intended for a fisherman physically or mentally. And then he says, and I thought then to myself that there were many things wrong with all of us and all our lives. And I wondered why my father, who was himself an only son, had not married before he was 40, and then I wondered why he had. I even thought that perhaps he had had to marry my mother and check the dates on the flyleaf of the Bible, where I learned that my oldest sister had been born a prosaic 11 months after the marriage, and I felt myself then very dirty and debased for my lack of faith and for what I thought, for what I had thought and done. And then there came into my heart a very great love for my father. And I thought it was very much braver to spend a life doing what you really do not want rather than selfishly following forever your own dreams and inclinations. And I knew then that I could never leave him alone to suffer the iron-tipped harpoons which my mother would forever hurl into his soul because he was a failure as a husband and a father who had retained none of his own. and I felt that I had been very small in a little secret place within me, and that even the completion of high school was for me a silly, shallow, selfish dream. Man.
That was fucking devastating.
It is.
It's so rough. And he's just taking, you know, you got to say, like, you want to shake him and say, you're taking on too much. You know what I mean? You got a life too. But that's our narrator here. And that's really the predictive, that stab in the heart that, you know, he says that maybe it's more heroic to spend your life doing something because someone else wanted you to do that thing. You know, it's, and how many people are in that boat? Not to make a cheesy pun.
No, it's true.
You know, how many? Most people, you know? And I that's why this story becomes kind of this you know, testament, you know, to that kind of lonely heroicness that a lot of people display without ever being recognized.
Hmm. Yeah.
And for me, one of the lines that struck me on this read was at a certain point, he does leave school and help his dad on the boat to try and shore things up. But the father accepts that without much encouragement. He accepts the help, but he doesn't encourage it. He would make no attempt to wake me himself. And for me, that really resonates with the opening. Father may be waiting at the bottom of the stairs, but he's not going to call up and say, hey, let's go. He's actually hoping that he'll sleep in and go to school, you know? And I don't know. It's just one of the great ones, right? It just is. It just is.
Yeah, and then, as if it weren't enough to reflect on the father that way, then near the end he says, it is not an easy thing to know that your mother lives alone on an inadequate insurance policy and that she is too proud to accept any other aid and that she looks through her lonely window onto the ice of winter and the hot, flat calm of summer and the rolling waves of fall and that she lies awake in the early morning's darkness when the rubber boots of the men scrunch upon the gravel as they pass beside her house on their way down to the wharf. And she knows that the footsteps never stop because no man goes from her house, and she alone of all the Lynns has neither son nor son-in-law who walks toward the boat that will take him to the sea. And it is not an easy thing to know that your mother looks upon the sea with love and on you with bitterness because the one has been so constant and the other so untrue.
So. And can I say, there's your ending. But then, you know, what separates the great from the magnificent is if you actually think that you can top that. And God knows, we both know that he does. And just the cadences of that paragraph with her is so powerful. And I like to imagine, you know, people at their desks and thinking, all right, that I got it right there. So constant and the other so untrue, bam, it's over. And then all of a sudden, maybe he stands up and stretches and looks out the window and he's like, oh, I'm not done yet. I'm not done yet. But neither is it easy to know. And then the story goes on.
Yeah. Because there is this kind of questioning as the reader where we're sort of like, what happened to him? What happened to the dad? But again, people must find the story and just make their way through these lives and find out what happens to him again and again. What happens at the very end, though? Alistair MacLeod is the author of The Boat. This has been The Lonely Voice with Peter Orner from Texas Public Radio. Jacob Rosati composed our theme music. Dan Katz is Texas Public Radio's news director. I'm Yvette Benavides.